Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 224th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You could get your daily reading from me and other writers over at SoccerNewsDay.com and locally on FansFavorite.com on the New York Red Bulls. Come on in. Chat room is open. Talk amongst yourselves if you like. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability as possible. And ladies and gentlemen, very soon, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific, on Fox Sports 1, the United States will be taking on Chile down in South America. It will be a very interesting contest to start off the 2015 U.S. men's national team schedule. That should be a pretty good challenge. Now, I don't know if Alexis Sanchez will be heading to his home country to take on the United States, even though this is not an official window of international matches from FIFA. But still, we'll see what happens if Sanchez will be allowed to head on down back to Chile to take on the United States. And, of course, once again, Fox Sports 1 will be showing U.S. men's national team games a couple of times this season. It should be a lot of fun. It should be exciting. It should be a great season for the U.S. men's national team. And speaking about Fox Sports 1, let me just say congratulations to John Strong. He is full-time now over at Fox Sports 1, calling Major League Soccer games, possibly as well as some national team games. We'll find out when he'll get his first opportunity calling an MLS game. Of course, I'm assuming he'll be over in Sporting Kansas City's home stadium at Sporting Park in Kansas City, Kansas, where the New York Red Bulls will start their season over in Sporting Kansas City's building. So we'll see what happens there. John Strong, of course, is a man very, very talented. Started his broadcasting venture, a native of Portland, Oregon, and covering the Portland Timbers until, obviously, he got his opportunity calling a couple of NBC games when the MLS was on NBC. And then from there, taking over full-time for Arlo White, of course, now calling EPL games on NBC. And then once NBC's contract was expired with MLS, he is now full-time with Fox Sports. Congratulations to John Strong. Very, very excited for him. A very, very good man. And hopefully whoever his partner will be in these games, whether it probably be Eric Wynalda or Brian McBride, who knows. But one thing is for sure is this, is that John Strong is going to do a heck of a job calling these games like he always does with anything he gets a handle on. And I know that John Strong will do a fantastic job. As we are coming down, ticking away the seconds, the minutes, the hours, the days, the weeks, and the months, what is going to happen with the collective bargaining agreement between Major League Soccer and the Players Union? You've heard several people on this show saying that there's not going to be a strike, there's not going to be a lockout, there's not going to be anything that's going to jeopardize the start of this season. But all of a sudden, the players just started to make some noise. The players' union has started to talk about a possibility of a strike if free agency does not come into play here in these negotiations. Now, I'm a person that I think, and this is just my opinion, of course, it would be nice to see free agency happen in Major League Soccer. I think that would be a very good thing to happen, because not only are you asking for these players' rights to be negotiated away, because let's be honest, if a certain team doesn't need a player anymore that's on their roster, they could just give up the rights right off the bat and say, go ahead, renegotiate with another team. That's all. This preciousness of free agency that goes on in the National Football League, Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, the NBA, and every other professional league around the world does not have these so-called single entity rules. But single entity, I think, will remain after this collective bargaining agreement is going to be signed. Single entity, obviously a bit of a pain in the butt, but you know what? You do understand why they're trying to do this, why they're trying to keep it as is. The last time that we were talking about a collective bargaining agreement, I believe I said back then it's not the right time to do it, to strike. I believed wholeheartedly a strike by the players' union was not the right way to go. And I said, the next collective bargaining agreement, that whatever's going to pop up, that this could be the right time to do it. And it's not so much about my opinion that the players should do it. Will the players do it? That's the number one question here. Will the players have the nerve to actually say, we want this now. If we're not going to get this now, we're going to strike. While I believe the players are talking a good game, it's about, can they put their plan into action and will it be put into play? That is the number one question right there. That is the number one question right there. Will the players act on their message? I don't want to call it a threat, because right now it's not a threat. I don't believe it is. Right now, it's just a message. We're going to have to wait and see what will happen when this new CBA is going to be currently being negotiated. Because right now, at the moment, yeah, you don't want to say it, but at the moment, talk is kind of cheap. Will they make this move? Will they force the hand of the owners and Commissioner Don Garber if they dare go on and strike? We're just going to have to wait and see. We're just going to have to wait and see what the situation will be and how it's going to be played. Because as of right now, no one believes this will happen. No one believes this will come to fruition. Because I'm telling you, there are a lot of skeptics out there that they don't believe the players are going to make this type of a move. That's all. Because, you know, we all want to see this league grow. We all want to see this league get better. We all want to see this league actually do the job and being one of the best leagues in the world. Are we there yet? I just don't believe we are at the moment. Listen, I'm happy this league is celebrating or will be celebrating 20 years next season, because right now this is the 20th season of Major League Soccer. as of right now, this league is going very strong and doing very well. And that's the most important part of this whole thing. And as much as I would like to believe that this is one of the best leagues in the world, I still don't think we're there yet. I still don't believe we're there yet. Positives are still growing, and that's what we want. Sadly, there are negatives. Sadly, there are negatives when it comes to some of the things that we've seen Major League Soccer do that just does not sit well with us. All we're asking for is a little bit more of a clarity, and of course, that wonderful word I talked about last week, transparency. That's what we need. That is what we need. Because I'm telling you right now, if we can get more transparency going, I think this league can go forward and this league can be a lot better. But as of right now, as we're seeing this, 20 years of Major League Soccer is on its way. Now, if you want to combine the NASL as a whole in those two stints, combined, it's 16 years. The NASL, when the Cosmos were around for Pele, that's 9 years. So as of right now, Major League Soccer has beaten the NASL in both forms. And as of right now, it's looking less. Do I think it's finally going to stick? I'd like to think so. I like to think so. I think we got ourselves a pretty good league going forward. We've got strong owners. We're developing players. It needs a lot more oomph, but still, we're going in the right direction. But there has to be patience. And that's all we need right now, because patience is on our side here. Patience is on the side here in the United States as we get ready to go and have some fun here with the 20th season of MLS. And let us hope, and I am hoping, here in Major League Soccer, we will have an agreement with both the players' union and the league. Hopefully we can continue the dialect, and hopefully more positives will come to both the players, the owners, and the league. I may be at times negative towards MLS, but that just means I want better and I want good for MLS. Just no more shenanigans. That's the only thing I don't want. I don't want shenanigans to just cloud the judgment of what's going on in this collective bargaining agreement negotiations and how the league will move forward from all of this. And hopefully it will say to everyone, this is the destination for players to come from around the world and play in Major League Soccer. I have a great show for you tonight. Later on, Michael Lewis of Big Apple Soccer will be joining me to discuss 40 years of writing about this wonderful game we call soccer and football. He'll be joining us. The head coach of the USL Pros expansion side, Colorado Springs Switchbacks FC, former U.S. International Steve Trichu, will be joining me as well. The early trade that we heard today between the Montreal Impact and the New York Red Bulls for Philippe Martinez and Ambrose Ayungo. But joining me first, very, very excited to have these gentlemen on to discuss their club. They are the owners of the National Premier Soccer League's Greater Lowell United FC. It is Mr. Manny Andrade and Mr. Tim Melican that joins me today. Gentlemen, thank you for the time and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Manny, obviously, we're all soccer fans here, and one day, of course, we've always dreamed about owning our own professional side. What got you interested in owning this team in Lowell, Massachusetts?
It was Tim Melican that approached me with this vision that he had about having a pro soccer here in northern Massachusetts, and because our area is very, very well saturated with youth soccer, and he believed that that his vision of a professional soccer team could thrive in this area. And Tim can talk
about it. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, Tim can talk a little bit more about the vision and how we made it into a reality.
Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, well, this area is saturated, like Manny said, with youth soccer, but also the first, you know, generation, second generation, Brazilians, Portuguese, Greeks, whose their first sport is soccer. Also, a lot of West Africans. So I figured that, you know, rather than them going to a Lowell Spinners, you know, baseball game or a hockey game, they're missing out on soccer because Foxborough is kind of a hike for us. Also, mm-hmm. in our area, we can draw from people up in Manchester and Concord and New Hampshire. So we could cut those people off from going down to Foxborough and try to, you know, provide them entertaining soccer.
No, that's fantastic, and that's wonderful. And obviously, excuse me, sorry about that. Obviously, you know, when you're going to see a professional soccer team in your area, I mean, we always think about the towns that are closer to Boston, like you said, to Foxborough, to New York, or to Chicago. We don't really talk about those other towns, those other big towns that could produce soccer players and could have the potential of having their own team. And Tim, why was the NPSL such a attractive league for your club to perform in?
Well, initially we were looking at the USL Pro until we, you know, realized that we just didn't have the funding to have a USL Pro club or an NASL club to start off with, especially with you know, nothing to show. So the NPSL was very user friendly, I'd say, very transparent, very communicative, and it just sounded like a fun league. Also, the fact that the league is so large, so that had a lot to do with the decision.
Mm-hmm. And Manny, of course, ever since the club got underway, how responsive have the town, your neighbors, been about coming to see Greater Lowell United play? And are your tickets just as affordable as, let's just say, the short season A league of the Lowell Spinners or the American Hockey League team? I don't know if it's still there or not. I knew there used to be
Lowell.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
but how affordable are tickets?
Tickets are affordable. For example, this year we're having adult tickets $5 and kids under 12 going free. Also, anyone who bears our jersey, that's their season ticket as well. So we're also introducing a new thing that if you buy a scarf between now and the beginning of the season, you can utilize that scarf as your season ticket as well. So it'll be very affordable for family of four to come in and see a professional type of atmosphere, great soccer play, and also the future of generation of soccer is playing in your own backyard, because the majority of the players that play in the NPSL level are under 23 college type players that are trying to make a name for themselves to play in a national type league. And that's that attracted us as well to the NPSL, was that it is a national league, the way they run their league is conducive cost-wise to have a program that not only you are able to survive but to thrive as well. And basically it will become our springboard basically to the pro level as well.
Now, Manny, to know this, obviously, right now in the 2015 season, your club is in the same conference with the Brooklyn Italians, the New York Athletic Club. Now the New York Cosmos have a under-23 side in your conference, Rhode Island Reds, and the two Seacoast United sides. How big of a challenge is the NPSL?
Well, it's a huge challenge, especially last year when we had not only the defending conference champions in our conference, but also the New York Red Bulls were also a force that I believe six of that of those players in that team actually played in the MLS as well. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it was a big challenge to be the first year club. We believe that if we handle our business a certain way, that we can not only be very successful, but also thrive and win our conference because the players that we attained this year, as opposed to last year as being the first year club, I believe we improved dramatically. I believe that is going to be a challenge. But in the same token, I think we have a better commitment from our players and coaches and staff as well.
Now, Tim, obviously the North American Soccer League has joined forces with the NPSL, which means their clubs will be allowed to have under-23 teams in wherever they're going to be in their divisions. Obviously, like we've already said, the New York Cosmos are in the same conference as your club in Greater Lowell United. How big of a partnership is that for the NPSL as well as for Greater Lowell, because you'll be facing some top teams from NASL with their under-23 sides?
Well, I personally love it. I wish it happened sooner, but I'm glad it happened now. It's great exposure for our players and also our club to be able to play against these teams, especially going to play the New York Cosmos reserve side. That's great exposure for our players and kind of like what the USL did with the MLS. But this, I honestly believe that this is the very beginning of what possibly, 5-10 years down the road could be the start of a promotion relegation with the NASL and NPSL, if we can just figure out the Soccer Federation cost of, say a team got promoted from the NPSL into the NASL, could they actually sustain and such? There's a lot of, crazy logistics, but I honestly think that that's the future, and that excites me. So that by them signing a partnership or agreeing to a partnership now, I think that means that is closer than we really think.
Now, Tim, let me ask you this, and I've been talking with Manny off and on through Twitter. You and Manny would love to find a way to promote Greater Lowell United into the NASL, and obviously that would be a wonderful thing to see a small town in Massachusetts. I mean, I don't know how small Lowell is. You guys are from there. You know more about it than I do. But how big of a dream would it be, and have you already started rolling on the possibilities of maybe building your own stadium to be involved in the NASL permanently as well as in the second division of American soccer?
Yes, we have. We've been working on that since day one behind the scenes as best we can. Now, Manny could talk a little bit more about the actual stadium end of it, but Lowell is actually alone. Like Lowell alone is the fifth largest city in Massachusetts. Now, Greater Lowell, if you count all the towns around us, that puts us close to 1 million people. So population-wise, so I think we're a massive area. And like I said, the demographic in the area is more significant, like with those first, first generation soccer, Portuguese, Brazilians, Greeks, like I said before, than there is down near Foxborough or even Boston. I think it's comparable. So I think we could sustain if we were in the NASL. It's just a matter of getting our ducks in a row behind the scenes where we can actually afford to do so. It'll take a few years to get our branding out there and promote better. But I think it's highly realistic to happen. But like I said, Manny could divulge a little bit more about the stadium end of things.
Yeah. In the stadium end of things, we've had an architect draw some schematics for us already, some preliminary drawings of a stadium that will be conducive to have a NASL type of crowd there, because I believe that you have to have your own stadium to be successful in any league. You can't be renting high school fields and be very successful at all, unless you have a huge youth program under you to sustain that type of cost. So we wanted to provide a stadium that will provide a great fan experience when they're watching the soccer game, and also to be a soccer specific stadium, not a general use type stadium. If I can beat the crafts into it, have the first soccer-specific stadium in Massachusetts. Just keep in mind, we're only 20 minutes away from Boston, and the North mm-hmm. Line is a 20-minute ride from Boston to Lowell. And so, therefore, we can get the fans from Metro Boston to come up to Lowell. It's a better ride, a shorter ride than going all the way to Foxborough, which is basically almost near Rhode Island. So it's more conducive for the metro area to come to Lowell rather than Foxborough. That's just my gathering. We are gathering a team of investors, and also not only to build the stadium, but also to put a package together to. If there is no pro relegation, which I'm for as well, then mm-hmm. to actually put a bid in to have an NASL franchise here, and we would do something similar to what the Cosmos have done. If there's no promotion relegation, then we'll have the under 23 reserve team with the NPSL, and also the pro side with the NASL. Some of what the Silverbacks have done and many other clubs have done with the NPSL.
Just out of curiosity, Manny, how many fans do you get a match in the NPSL at home? Is it a good number? Where do you currently play your games at?
Well, we play at College Stadium, which is a city-owned field that houses up to 7,000 people. But the high school, the Lowell High, has the rights to that field. So there is a lot of limitations what we can do with advertising-wise and what we can bring and cannot bring into the stadium. So to have a professional type of atmosphere, so our hands are kind of like cuffed, basically, because it was so restricted. Of what we can do in the stadium itself. So basically, we utilize that stadium. As for the fans, it was our first year last year, and we opened our home opener was against the Brooklyn Italians. And with that being said, we brought in close to 400 people into the stadium. We were the highest attendance of any of the teams in our conference, and because of that, I think that we built a momentum that we've had some season ticket holders already purchase some tickets for next year, and our projections are basically going to be double, if not triple, that attendance for the 2015 year. We did partner up this year and moving forward with a local Portuguese American center, which have a historic soccer fans that they were in the old Lager League here in Massachusetts, that they played. They used to pay some of the guys about $2,000 a game back in the mid-'80s, early 70s. And it was a big, big league here in Massachusetts, and they actually shipped players from Brazil and from Portugal, from Greece to play here. And some of these players, when MLS first came around, they refused to go to MLS because they were getting paid more with the PAC, which is the Blues Club, in the Lager League rather than going to the MLS level. So, and
well,
I think
gentlemen,
both fans are going to come with us too. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's great. No, that's fine. No, I just want to make sure we're all finished here. But listen, gentlemen, I thank you a lot for the time. I really do appreciate it. And listen, good luck this year in the NPSL. And I really do hope your dreams moving up to the NASL does happen. Keep doing the good work. Thank you again. Love to have both of you on again at another time. Thank you so much, and have a good evening, and good luck this year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Melican and Manny Andrade, the owners of the Greater Lowell United FC and the NPSL, as they had a very good year last year, and they want to go further this year in the NPSL, and I bet you right now they also want to go further and become a part of the professional soccer scene. They are in the under-23 level right now, but obviously they want to go further up in the professional levels that is the NASL. So we'll see what happens with those teams, or with that team, deep in the future. And as we get ready for my next guest, as we get ready to talk about a gentleman who is, I mean, let's be honest, being 40 years in the business of writing about American soccer, that's a heck of a run, and it's nothing to sneeze at. And let me just say that I am fortunate and lucky enough to be in the same press room with him at Red Bull Arena from Big Apple Soccer as well as New York Newsday. Michael Lewis is with us. Michael, thank you for the time. Congratulations on 40 years in the soccer writing business. You have earned it, sir.
Thank you very much for the kind words. Sometimes I feel like it was only yesterday that I got into it. And well, I'm still around to tell a story once in a while.
Absolutely. I have to ask you this question, though. And when you were starting off writing, obviously I know back in the day it's baseball. I mean, we love to talk about baseball at times. And then I know you're from upstate New York, from Western New York, up in Rochester, covering the Lancers back in the old NASL days. When did you get hooked into the sport and why?
Well, actually, I'm from Long Island originally, and my first job was in Rochester, New York with the Democrat and Chronicle. And all I wanted to do is be a regular sports writer and cover the sports I grew up with, whether it was baseball, football, basketball, hockey, and maybe an occasional unusual sport. At the time, there was a team in town called the Rochester Lancers. I'll try to make this long story as short as possible. Even though I was covering the high school beat like most young writers do. They start out covering high schools. So it's a great proving ground. You've got to cover many sports. And if there was one sport I didn't want to cover, was the professional soccer team up there. They had a lot of adventures off the field I really didn't want to have anything to do with in covering. And apparently the sports editor, Larry Grable, must have seen something that he was impressed with me and decided to give me the beat. And it happened on a cold January night, not unlike what we're experiencing this January night 40 years ago. Bill Parker, the assistant sports editor of the paper, calls me over to his desk and starts explaining something to me. And I noticed there was a stack of files on his desk. And the more he talked, I'm thinking, oh, Lord, this is my worst nightmare, because it sounds more and more I'm going to be covering the Lancers. And at the end of the spiel, he said, congratulations, you're covering your first professional team. And he pushes literally the files toward me. And all I wanted to do was push it back to him and say no thanks. At the time, I must have been 7 months into my first job. Newspaper had, a one-year probation period, so they could technically fire me any time they wanted. And since I always wanted to be a sports writer and I am not suicidal, I accepted the assignment. And it was rough in the beginning. Actually, the biggest problem I had, I remember, was trying to talking to an English player whose accent I could not figure out. Ironically, it was Tommy Ord, which eventually I did, but I remember that first interview, Lord knows how much went over my head or under my head what he was saying, but it really took probably 3 years before I really got into the sport big time, that I figured out that this is going to be an interesting sport. I think it slowly grew on me, because in the beginning I was ignorant about it. Now, some of my critics might say I'm still ignorant about it today, but we'll leave that for another time. But seriously, you know, when you're ignorant about something, you know, you're not enthusiastic about it. But slowly but surely, I learned. And the thing is, way back then, this is the Stone Age compared to so many people, what we have today. We were using typewriters back then. It was just at the end of the typewriter era. There was only one soccer show on TV at the time, and it was videotaped and put on a week later, Soccer Made in Germany. There was no internet, you know, so I couldn't look up things. You know, you had to look under rocks for soccer information. I went to local bookstores and bought some soccer books. And even though that gave me background, the only way to learn about something is to watch it, or better yet, play it, but I didn't do too much of that beforehand. So I'm sorry for the long answer, but it took 3 years before I felt comfortable in my own skin with the sport. And then after that, I just said, hey, this is a lot of fun. I want to see how long I can cover it for. And knock on wood, I've been able to do it for my entire life at all levels, too. I mean, I just don't cover professional and national. I've covered youth soccer, high school soccer, amateur, semi-pro, college, you name it. It's whatever level. And to me, there's a story. Everyone has a story. It's up to the writer to figure out what he is about.
Obviously,
and how interesting it is.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I was about to say, you know, you've covered, as much as I've known you, I know you've covered a lot of World Cups. You've seen a lot of strong play with this U.S. men's national team. Just out of curiosity, were you down in Trinidad and Tobago that fateful game where Paul Caligiuri scored the goal heard round the world?
Yes, I was. I had the one of my earliest international trips at the time, and because my first trip ever out of this continent, Canada is not included, nothing against Canada, but it was in 1982, and that was in 1989, so pretty remarkable time there, a lot of fun times there. I remember me and a number of other journalists were walking the streets of Port of Spain beforehand, and we were getting teased by some of the people there, because in the entire country was in like a sea of red. They put out their flags or anything red outside where they lived, and they were teasing us, saying, you're going to lose, but they were doing it very jokingly. I mean, it wasn't anything nasty about it at all. And it was almost like some sort of a festival down there. In fact, they declared, even before the game had kicked off, they declared that Monday a national holiday, even though that Trinidad hadn't qualified. And unfortunately, they didn't for their sake. But we figured out, though, me and some of the other journalists admitted, the U.S. doesn't make it. The traveling fans who support Trinidad at Italia 90 are going to put on a show, too. and they would be a lot of fun to watch. But as we all know, Paul Caligiuri made sure that was not going to happen with one of the most memorable goals in U.S. soccer history.
Absolutely. If I can ask you to pick one story local and one story national on the U.S. national team throughout your writing career, what would be the best local story you would have, whether it be Rochester or the Red Bulls / Metro Stars? And for the national team, what would be your greatest memories in writing those articles?
Well, I guess the one that probably stands, I mean, you know, Trinidad is a big deal because if we don't have, the United States doesn't have that win in 1990, we don't know how history goes on from there. My gut feeling is soccer does grow in this country, but at a different rate, and I can't even begin to know the permutations of that. But I would say, though, Landon Donovan's goal against Algeria was something special because of what was at stake, getting out of the first round, winning the group for the first time in the World Cup, and an awareness in this country that people understood what this was about. People were at bars watching this game. With all due respect to the U.S. national team in 1989, that wasn't a big problem. You know, that wasn't a problem at all. Soccer was still, so to speak, in the closet. You know, it was only for the super-duper soccer fans in this country. So I would put the Landon Donovan thing as the most memorable. It got me thinking off the top of my head on that. Domestically, I'm gonna cheat and say two things.
Sure.
In 1977, I covered a remarkable playoff series between Rochester and the Croatia. And just to put it into proper perspective, you listen to that name, Metro's Croatia, you know who backed them, the Croatian community in Toronto. Well, Rochester was coached by a Serbian and had several Serbian players. So when Rochester went up to Toronto, it was always literally a mini war. And this is before the Serbian-Croatia situation had gotten major publicity. I was learning about history and world politics on the fly then. Well, there were two remarkable games. I'll try to put it in a nutshell. And this was in a two-game playoffs before the winner would play the Cosmos in the semifinals of Pelé's final year as a pro in 1977, putting this all into perspective. In the first game, it was a crazy game. Went 120 minutes, went into a shootout. A Rochester player actually got two yellow cards in the game but was never sent off. It was crazy, but Rochester managed to win 1-0 in the shootout. And there were so many other crazy things happening. And I remember the lead I put on my story is it was a soccer game to end all soccer games. And it, believe it or not, at the time, I was wondering, was that a good lead? And it still stands up today, I believe. Well, the second leg was played in Toronto. Rochester never wins in Toronto. Rochester gets two players thrown out by halftime. They're playing 9-11 against Toronto. I'm thinking, well, it was a good season. Well, the Rochester coach, Don Popovich, comes out with this defense, which makes Catenaccio look ultra-liberal, where he's just basically got one forward who's essentially a midfielder. He's got like four central defenders. Rochester manages to pull, and I said, if Rochester's going to win this, they're going to have to play for a tie in, you know, beyond over. At that time, we called it overtime, not extra time, and win the shootout. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what happens? Rochester scores with 12 minutes left of the game on a rare shot by them, and they win 1-0. So that is,
wow.
I have to put those two games together because of all that. And getting into the locker room afterwards, I mean, the Croatian fans were nuts or at least angry and whatnot. And, it was a crazy night, but it was two memorable games back-to-back. Rochester, incidentally, lost to the Cosmos in the semifinals, and Pelé won the NASL championship in his final year. Okay, then I guess back home, the thing that sticks out in my mind more than anything else probably be Clint Mathis in early 2001. everything he touched turned to gold. You know, two games that were remarkable, very, very close early that year, when he did that incredible 70-yard run against against
Dallas.
The Dallas Burn, not FC
right.
Dallas, but the Dallas Burn, which
that's
was
right.
our version of Michael Owen's run or Diego Maradona's run. But, you know, people might say, well, it was only the MLS, but hey, how many players do you see score like that? Well, that was something remarkable. And then a few days later, Mathis comes back and scores a hat-trick against Kansas City, which, you know, a hat-trick is done all the time. But the thing is, he did it with his left foot, right foot in his head. That doesn't happen every day. And he was at the top of his game, and unfortunately, while training with the U.S. national team, he blew out his knee. He did come back from it, but I don't know if he was ever the same player. But it was incredible magic times, because I said, I've never seen a U.S. player do something like this consistently. And I was at both those games at Giants Stadium, and it was remarkable. And I'll tell you this, I live for moments like that. And I don't care if it's an American player, a German player, an Iranian player, or a Martian. I just live for moments like that where I could be entertained. So I'm sorry for the long answer. But
nope, that's quite all right. Listen, 40 years in the business and 40 more hopefully for you. Michael, thank you for the time, and I will definitely see you at Red Bull Arena this MLS season. Hopefully there won't be a lockout or a strike. Thank you, Michael, and have a
You're
good
welcome.
Night.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Thank you. Michael Lewis, once again, 40 years of soccer writing, and, of course, he did talk about that great moment down in Trinidad Tobago by Paul Caligiuri of the U.S. Men's National Team. Of course, a player like that had a teammate like this gentleman who is now the head coach of the expansion side, Colorado Springs Switchbacks FC, former U.S. international and the new head coach of the club, Mr. Steve Trichu. Mr. Trichu, thank you for your time. I really do appreciate it, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was good to listen to that, a little bit of history of soccer there. That was great.
Oh, wasn't that? It brought back all those great memories back in the day, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, it's great, and it's great to hear back, you know, the NASL days and all those two things, too. It's just, you know, not a lot of people these days know about that, and it's great history of soccer in this country.
It really, really is. And my first question to you is, what the heck is a switchback?
Yeah, I guess you got to live in Colorado to kind of know what it is, but you know, as you're either doing a run up a mountain, you know, a trail bike up a mountain, it's when you're going up and then you got to cut back. So that's what a switchback is. So it's kind of, you know, a thing in Colorado or in the mountains. But I guess you got to be here to kind of really know what it is.
Yeah, you're the local, you're the expert, and I'll take your word for it. But
yeah, well, they made the name before I was hired, so, you know, that one's not on me.
Okay. You're saying that you're not involved? That's impossible.
Not in the name, no. I was involved with the logo and everything, but not with the name, no.
Okay, no, I'll take your word for it. Don't worry about it. But honestly, though, what does it mean for you as a former player of this game to be involved on the coaching end of things? Because obviously you've had probably some pretty good coaches in your time as a player, high school, college, national team, when you were playing in professional leagues. What does it mean to maybe soak in all that knowledge and now give it to these players of the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I kind of have done throughout my career. I mean, you know, the way soccer was in the States, you know, back then, you kind of had to jump around from town to town or city to city and or country to country, like kind of like I did. So, you know, I tried to take as much from each coach that I had. You know, I had some great national team coaches in Lothar Osiander, Bob Gansler. I was a little bit with Bora Milutinovic, and then Steve Sampson also. So, you know, there are some great coaches there, and then the coaches I've had throughout my professional career. Like I said, I try to take all the positive things out of them, and you know, people always say that, you know, the players take on the coach's personality. So, you know, I hope these guys do that, because, you know, really what the USL Pro is about is developing kids for that next level. We've got some good young guys that we've signed, and hopefully we can develop them and they can make that next level, whether that's here in the MLS, NASL, or abroad somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be with an MLS club, even though I'm still kind of scratching my head that I believe the Rapids are not your MLS affiliate right now. Is that true?
That's true. You know, it's just not us scratching our head. There's people in the USL Pro or starting just the USL and also the MLS trying to figure out that one. But you know, I met with them and tried to see what their thoughts were. But in the end, they decided to go with Charlotte. So you know, more power to them, and we're going to do our thing here.
So. When are you going to start bringing over the front office people and spike the drinks? No, I'm just joking. Don't do that. Don't do that. But
yeah, right.
Don't do that. But anyway, what is it about Colorado Springs that makes it such a very good location for professional soccer players to come, not just to play or to be coached by you, but still, what is it about Colorado Springs that makes it attractive for a professional player to come over?
You know, for one thing, I mean, the Colorado Springs is a beautiful city. I mean, you know, once guys get here, and that was kind of how I was when I, you know, when I was drafted back when the MLS started and coming into Denver. I mean, I had been here a few times, but, you know, coming here and seeing the city and you know, the weather here is great, you know, but, you know, we're trying to sell it that you know, come here, let's get this thing going. I mean, being an expansion team. We're kind of starting from scratch, and you know, I tried to sell it to a lot of players, but I had tons of players contact me wanting to come here. You know, guys that have lived here, guys that have just been here, and I had, you know, in guys within the MLS that, you know, kind of don't have jobs anymore that contacted me. But it's been pretty much an easy sell, and we're kind of far enough away from Denver where we're our own kind of market here, because we're a good hour and 15 minutes from downtown Denver. So, you know, it's kind of hard for a lot of people to make that trek all the way up to Commerce City and everything, which is about an almost 2 hour drive. So, you know, the people here, the soccer community, they've taken great to us. And, you know, now we just got to put the quality on the field and get those people to come back game after game.
Obviously you've been a defender in your career, but out of curiosity, what is your philosophy when it comes to coaching a club or a team or even kids? Do you want to attack more? Do you want to be a little more technical, defending most of the time? What does Steve Trichu like to do on the field with tactics and formations?
Well, you know, I think I've done a pretty good job of identifying players, the kind of players that I want. I mean, I want total players. You know, I don't want just guys that are just attackers, guys that are just defenders. You know, I want my defenders to attack. I want my attackers to defend. And what I've tried to instill, I mean, I was, you know, even when I was the 4 years assistant with the Rapids, dealing with the younger guys, trying to teach them the right way to play the game, the nuances of the game and things like that. And then I've done some coaching in college. I've done some youth coaching, and just the same thing. But, you know, in the springs here, and one thing that, you know, when I was playing here, when Glenn Meyerning, Mooch, was our coach here, is we wanted to use the altitude to our advantage. I mean, we're another 1,000 feet up here than Denver. So that's one of the things I want to instill these players is we're going to run these teams into the ground. They're going to be gasping for air those last 20, 30 minutes. But, you know, there hasn't been teams, I'm not going to mention the team, but these teams in this area haven't really done that, you know. So, but that's going to be part of it. But you know, I like the total soccer player, you know, and the formations. I mean, I got to get the team together and I got an idea of how I want to play, but it is going to be, you know, the speed of play for me is the biggest thing. You know, moving the ball is quick, and that's one of the things the younger guys going to that next level have to understand. That's one of the biggest part about it. You know, that speed of play, as you get to the higher levels, it's even quicker than that. So trying to instill them in doing that here is going to make them better for that next level.
How excited is the town of Colorado Springs? I mean, I've seen videos. Everyone looks ready to go, raring to go. Yeah. you're there. How is the level of excitement?
Oh, it's great. Like I said, the community's taken to us. We had a we had an exhibition game back in October. We brought LA2 in and Arizona United from the USL Pro just to have an exhibition game, kind of work the kinks out of the stadium. So my owner put like $2 million renovation into it. And it's a great facility for USL Pro. It can hold up to 4,000 people. It's nice and tight. It's a grass field. And so, you know, but the community here, they just wanted more. They came out of that game saying, when's the season going to start? And now it's upon us, and you know, sponsorship's going great. Season tickets are going great. So, like I said, now it's just putting those players on the field and getting some quality games and getting some quality wins out of it.
I guess I have to ask you this question, but, you know, you were a part of that national team down in Trinidad and Tobago to take on the Soca Warriors for that precious, precious World Cup spot to Italy in 1990.
Right.
What was it like being on the field when Paul Caligiuri scored that big goal heard around the world?
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, and, you know, looking back on it, because – and, you know, we talk about every once in a while when I see the guys, whether John Doyle, Brian Bliss, Peter Vermes. I saw those guys a couple of weeks ago down in Florida for the MLS Combine. And, you know, that game always comes up. And really, for me, when I look back on it, everything went so fast. The game went fast, except about the last 10 minutes. I can remember that because they were all over us, but they didn't score. But just the relief we all felt when that game was over. I mean, I just fell on the ground and thinking about it, it was like, man, we still got something to play for after this, because, you know, who knows, like the writer before me said, who knows where soccer would have been if we didn't qualify and we didn't win that game. Like you said, I think soccer would have grown in this country, but, you know, that was the start of it. We've been in every World Cup since then. The MLS is growing year after year. And so, you know, where's the limit on soccer in this country? I mean, it keeps growing, and hopefully it'll keeps getting better and better.
Absolutely. And Major League Soccer will start its 20th season this March.
Yeah.
From the time you've seen it begin up till now, do you feel there's more improvement for the game in this country, or do you think it's fine the way it is?
No, I think there's improvement. I do think, though, that, you know, they're still talking about expansion, but sooner or later they have to stop. I mean, they can't keep growing more and more, because the quality of players aren't really at that, you know, to find as many players for as many teams they're going to have, they're going to have to go out of the country and bring in more foreigners, which we saw what happened back in the NASO when they kept bringing foreigners and foreigners. The American player got kind of squeezed out. We got to keep developing our American players in this country where they're on a big stage. But like I said, I mean, they got to get to a point for the MLS where they got to, you know, I don't know how many teams that is, but they got to get to a point where they stop and just keep growing those teams and making them stronger and stronger. I mean, even here in Denver, I mean, it's really not where it should be. I mean, the Rapids, you know, once they got their new stadium, everybody thought it was going to take off, but it's in such a place that really no one wants to go to that part of the city, because there's really nothing out there. You know, they have to have these stadiums in the downtown areas where, you know, there's all the nightlife going on and everything, that there's things around it. You know, your Portland's doing it right, the Seattle's doing it right, and just build it like that, because I think that's what the American fan wants. They want not just the soccer part of it, but they want the entertainment part of it outside of the soccer. So I think, like I said, I do think there's still a lot of growth to be in this country, but they got to get to a point where they stop and then keep and then grow those clubs as big as they can get.
Steve, thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate it. Good luck this year in USL Pro League, and hopefully some success to your Colorado Spring Switchback. Thank you so much.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Steve Trichu, former U.S. international defender, and very good there. I just made an error. Sorry about that, Kevin. Call back. I wasn't trying to cut him off. Oh, no. Oh, boy, I feel horrible now. Oh, geez. There we go. Good, good, good. Let me just say this. I want to thank again Steve Tritschu, the head coach and former U.S. international defender of the Colorado Springs Switchbacks, for being on the show. Joining me now, and I'm sorry, Kevin, I wasn't trying to cut you off. That was an accident. He cut off first. I was trying to take him off the switchboard, and then he beat me to the punch, and I knocked you out by accident. Kevin Laramie,
no problem. I'm here.
Podcast,
I'm back.
Montreal Impact, of course. I was on his show on a live YouTube show with him today, and he's with me today, of course, to talk about what happened on a crazy Tuesday. Montreal Impact and the New York Red Bulls made a deal. It was sending over Philippe Martin's allocation money, as well as the number one spot in the allocation order to the Red Bulls for Ambrose Ayongo, as well as Eric Alexander, and a few other things as well. Kevin, obviously, this is a big trade for both teams, but as we talked about earlier on your show, you feel this is advantage Montreal.
I do, especially now that Montreal went and got a Ojuro later on today, a striker that they needed. Now they have Eric Alexander, to consistent, solid midfielder that used to be good for New York, 34 games average since 2010, played per year, which is a lot for a defender. And that's what Montreal needs, somebody that's going to consistently play in MLS this season, because he's compared with New York, so he's not going to be able to play in the CONCACAF Champions League for Montreal. But the fact that Ayongo and Alexander at Cuptide, it's going to make them focus on MLS, and it's less of a hassle for the coach because he already knows that those two players are only going to play in MLS, and I think that's positive going forward.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, right now you have a big matchup, depending on what happens with the CBA negotiations, but I do understand that if there is a lockout or a strike, I do understand that the MLS will allow their clubs, DC United and Montreal, to be involved in the quarterfinals of the CONCACAF Champions League 14-15 season. So at least there's some positives. You will get some matches.
Exactly. There's been talk about an unwritten agreement, or maybe a handshake, that's been dealt between the So Players Association and MLS, that they will allow their club to play in the CONCACAF Champions League, or they won't do a strike or a lockout until the clubs are out of it, which makes sense because season only starts a month and a half from now. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. Pachuca is going to be a very interesting adversary and opponent for the Montreal Impact at the end of February. The return leg is going to be in Montreal at the Big O in front of hopefully what's going to be a huge crowd. The decisive game is playing in Montreal. We don't usually see that in the Champions League. We're used to the other way around. So that could be interesting, and Ojuro is going to be able to play in that game, one of the piece that was missing. But today, Felipe to New York and Ayongo to Montreal are probably the biggest keys in the trade. We'll see what New York does with their international, their first top spot of allocation process. So it's going to be very interesting, and like you said earlier, it was a busy Tuesday, very busy.
Yes, it wasn't busy, but in a way it was. So that's only for us, though. That's it. But still, you know, about Philippe Martins, obviously it sounds like he's kind of like a jack-of-all-trades type of midfielder. He can be in the middle. He can be on the wing on the left, be on the wing on the right. So it sounds like...
But you don't want him on the right. You don't want him on the wing, Daniel, to be honest. You want him in the midfield. You want him in the central attack position. Don't put him deeper because he's going to have trouble finding space. He's best when he's alone in the midfield. What I mean is when he's part of either a three or himself in the middle, when he have a lot of space to move around. When he's playing with somebody close to him in the midfield, he doesn't quite seem to find his footing and find his space on the pitch. And it doesn't have the space to exploit his skill and his talent. He needs a lot of space to do that. And himself, by himself in the midfield, usually that's where he thrives.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, you know, with Ayongo going to Montreal, I mean, he at least answers a couple of questions about, you know, where you're going to put him. I mean, you could put him as a left back, a right back. He can be a right wing midfielder. He can be a left wing midfielder as well. I mean, he can cross the ball for you for target strikers. He can bring up the ball. He can juke around a couple of times on the defender, make him look silly, and then just cross it in a very, what looks like not to be a dangerous situation, can become a dangerous situation if you give him time and space on the ball.
Yeah, it does seem like this. So Yondo seems very confident with the ball, not being afraid to overlap when he's playing in a fullback position. And when he's subbed in the midfield, deep midfield, he can be really useful by just sparking that attack on the wing side of the pitch, which we're really not used to in Montreal. We need somebody that can do that. We've seen young product in the league, like the Yedliner, being known for that and now being part of Tottenham. Hopefully, Oyongo can bring the same type of attack flair in the fullback for the Montreal Impact.
Yeah, absolutely. But what do you make about Frank Klopas' first season with Montreal? Obviously, it was a terrible year last year. We all know Davao has retired. And the only good thing, the only good four games you had was in the CONCACAF Champions League, and now you're in the quarterfinals. But do you think these new players will mesh with what Frank Klopas wants from the Impact?
I think slowly Frank Klopas is starting to have the assets that he needs to be able to have a decent team on the pitch. Last year, he didn't really shy about it, but he was not necessarily happy with the moves that Nick DeSantis made when he was the technical director of the Impact. Well, more of the general manager. It was a weird system last year. This year is actually the pyramid of, or the organizational pyramid is more clear. Adam Braz in the last couple of weeks with Frank Klopas have already built a totally different defense, focused on French-speaking defender that can actually help give the team an exotic flair that we don't really see in MLS. And it's going to be great to have that. But the team itself, the holes that were needed to be plugged have slowly been plugged low profile in the last couple of weeks. And it's really starting to look really good. Adam Braz have impressed me. Frank Klopas as well, both together, have really able to correct the bad trades of 2014. If you could say, because on top of being bad last year on the pitch, off the pitch, they were not that much better either. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Montreal now that all those trades are done. But I think it's going to be Frank Klopas. He can't have a worse 2015 that he had in 2014.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was going to say I had a little mic issue. I apologize for that. I was going to say, we all know about Montreal, obviously French-Canadian town in the province of Quebec in Canada. I mean, it's always good to have a player who has come from, whether it's France itself or in Africa, there's a French nation in Africa that, you know, players can get used to, can you know, feel comfortable being in town. Do you feel Oyongo could be a lot comfortable now because he'll be playing in Montreal this season?
We'll see. After the trade today, it's been rumors that Oyongo wasn't really happy about the trade, that he was traded without his knowledge and stuff like that. So we'll see what his adjustment period is in Montreal. Hopefully that all changes when he comes to town and meet everybody. And hopefully he sits in really quickly.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Obviously, his agent also wasn't happy about the trade that he wasn't informed about either. But, you know, they have to understand, you know, this is North America-style, you know, contracts and trades and all that other fun things because, you know, you're going to get traded and you're not going to like it sometimes. And you're going to feel, I know, obviously, he enjoyed being in New York, I understand. But this is the nature of the business here with sports in North America. Sometimes you're not going to get informed about trades, and tough. That's how it is in this business. You know, I mean, personally, I have to admit that I wasn't at first a fan of this deal. But then again, you got to give up something to get something, and that's what the Red Bulls did. They went after Philippe Martinez, and they had to jettison both Eric Alexander and Ambrose Oyongo. And, of course, a couple other financial moves as well as the allocation order moves to an allocation money to make everything happen. And obviously you feel it's a win for Montreal right now. I feel at the moment there's no win on either side. I think both sides addressed their needs of what they needed and what holes had to be filled. But we'll see what happens. But still, you know, for Montreal, you know, been to the playoffs once. Last year was Vancouver into the playoffs for the first time, and as you know, Toronto is jealous. But but still, Kevin, it seems like Frank Klopas is starting to develop and assemble the club he wants to go forward in his vision.
That's exactly what I think as well. That's exactly the way it looks like. He did not shy away last week at the beginning of the training camp. If you go to the Off the Woodworks show last week, I did about an 8-minute interview with Frank Klopas. That's on the show, his first day of training camp press scrum. And he's not shy of talking about where he still thinks he needs a striker and he needs players like this. And look, Oduro got traded for today. And I think his relationship with Adam Braz might be better than his relationship was with DeSantis. And I think together they can achieve something more, at least maybe not a playoff, but close to it. At least not being the laughingstock of Major League Soccer like they were last year. And I think they're already in the right direction for that right now, Daniel.
Oh, it sounds like it. Yep, it sounds like it. I definitely agree with you. And I really do believe that they're starting to get back. I'll be honest with you. I've always felt Montreal should have always been that club, not just from within Canada, but within the Eastern Conference of MLS, that they were probably the ones to ascend higher than what Toronto's been. I mean, Toronto always has those great starts, but it's not about how you start, it's how you finish. And Toronto has fizzled really quickly. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where I believe that Montreal should be ahead of where the other two Canadian teams are. But right now, Vancouver and Montreal are probably the stronger of the three.
Absolutely. Right now, Montreal and Toronto really made some great moves in the offseason. Not as flash. Well, Toronto's still flashy with Giovinco and Altidore. Montreal, not as flashy as a Devaillé or a Vanesta, but more productive on the pitch. We're talking about the Laurent Simard signed last week, a defender from Belgium, from the Stade de Liège, who comes in Montreal for the right reason, for the benefit of his family. And on top of it, he's going to be able to play and play a major part of the Montreal defense. That's going to be interesting. Baki Soumaré from Chicago, who was selected as the first choice in the second part of the reentry draft a couple of weeks ago. Still not sold on the guy. Still believe he can be a little reckless on the pitch at the most inopportune time. We'll see what his tenure with the Montreal Impact say. But on top of it, you get a lot of new defenders. Oyongo, you get a great new mentality. And I think a lot of, not necessarily problem in the locker room, but a lot of people that were maybe disgruntled have left the ship. And now we're left with a positive, clean slate heading into 2015. The 2014 season has been forgotten. And I believe 2015 might be the season where we finally get a consistent season where the result we get at the beginning are consistent to the results we have at the end of the season.
Absolutely. Kevin, thanks again for being on the show. I'll definitely talk to you during the preview shows and continue success with Off the Woodwork podcast. And I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right. No problem. Kevin Laramie, Off the Woodwork podcast, Two Solitudes podcast, the king of podcasts of Canada. And before I say goodbye, I want to do Nathan Carr a solid. I want to play the whole thing that I had to abruptly end, and that will finish off today's show. So here is again Nathan Carr, World Cup qualifying setup for CONCACAF and the Under-20 tournament.
And once again, 40 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show, as we get ready and talk about wonderful things in CONCACAF, once again, of course, from the home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com. It is Mr. Nathan Carr. Thank you, Nathan, for coming back.
No, thank you. Thanks, everyone.
No problem. No problem at all. So here we go. We're going to go with the World Cup qualifying draw first, rounds 1 and 2. Very interesting draw, what we have here in the first round. I have to say, I didn't understand why it was so much laughter in the W Hotel when the Bahamas was drawn against Bermuda. I guess that's a big derby match.
Yeah, I wasn't too sure either. It's geographically, they're not that close together, because Bahamas is north and Bermuda's sort of, maybe it is a geographical thing. I'm not too sure, because Bermuda isn't exact right next to Bahamas. Bahamas against Turks and Caicos Islands might have been a little bit more of a rivalry, but there seemed to be quite a lot of laughter for lot of the draws, actually. But, no, that Bahamas against Bermuda, I think that's one of the standout matchups, actually, of the first round. That's going to be really close. And I know that Bermuda are already in training. They've assembled a training camp with a few local-based players. And then you've got, like, Naki Wells and Reggie Lamb, who play in England, who are going to join up. So that should be a really a fun game to watch. And then a few other standouts as well from that first round for me. Turks and Caicos host St. Kitts and Nevis first, and then in the second leg, St. Kitts hosts that. That'll be an interesting one. I know St. Kitts and Nevis will be expected to win that. And then Curaçao, who are, for me, are the strongest team in the first round, Curaçao. They play Montserrat, and I've been talking to a few of the Montserrat players on social media, and they said that, you know, they're by no means going to underestimate Curaçao, and that should be a good game.
It really will be. I know you've been really concentrating on Suriname, and even though they've been drawn the second round, they're going to face the winners of Nicaragua or Angola. I would like to think maybe Nicaragua has a little bit of an advantage here, just being a Central American side, but not much is known about Angola, honestly, and that could be either a strong matchup against Suriname in the second round, or maybe Angola could surprise people.
I'm not sure Angola. I watched Angola at the 2014 Caribbean Cup last year, and they're a country that is lacking seriously. I mean, they're not very well developed in terms of, you know, facilities or you know, talent in that country. And I think they let in something like 20 goals, and they might have scored one. So I expect Nicaragua to beat Anguilla quite convincingly in the first round. And then, yeah, as you say, it's a tough start for Suriname, that. I can think of a few other islands that that would have given them maybe an easier game. But it very much depends with Suriname. We should hear soon, by the way, about, if you listened to last week's show, about the bill that's been submitted. We should hear soon if that's been successful or not. But I don't know too much about Nicaragua, actually. Obviously, they're Central American, so that usually means that they've got some sort of upper hand over the Caribbean teams. But that should be interesting to watch that one. There's lots and lots of interesting matchups. Another one in the second round is St. Vincent and the Grenadines against Guyana. Because I know that Guyana have just appointed a new manager for a friendly against Barbados in early February. And it'll be interesting to see, will they keep with Jamal Shabazz, who's the new manager there in Guyana, for the World Cup qualifiers? Because he so impressively led them, Guyana, to the third round in the 2014 qualifying cycle. So that's one to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, in the second round as well, Antigua and Barbuda taking on St. Lucia. To me, that sounds like an interesting matchup, depending on, I guess, who's stronger than the other. But still, I think Antigua and Barbuda is going to probably be a tough, tough side.
Yeah, Antigua and Barbuda are a team that are developing nicely. They didn't do as well as they would have liked in the 2014 Caribbean Cup, but they've really tapped into the British diaspora, and they've plucked a few guys who play in the English lower leagues. And you've got players like Jorin John of Nuneaton, players like Jordan Smith of Stamford, and a guy from Blackburn, Aaron Tumwa. So Antigua have got a strong team, but then again, I know I said last time I was on the show, you know, St. Lucia, a team that, you know, you really can't underestimate. So they're two very even teams, Antigua and St. Lucia, and then you've got Puerto Rico against Grenada. Grenada are another team that are trying to tap into the British diaspora. I know that Chinny Joseph, the president there at the Grenada Football Association, is working very hard to try and track down some guys who are eligible for Grenada, who can help them. So you know, Canada as well. Canada were in a pot by themselves, weren't they? But they've been drawn against British Virgin Islands or Dominica. So I can see them. That's quite a favourable draw, I think. I can see them progressing to round three.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Puerto Rico, obviously, you're going to have probably a lot of dual citizenships coming from the New York City area, and a lot of Puerto Ricans in New York City that will probably play for the national team down in Puerto Rico against Grenada, and that should be pretty interesting there as well. So that will be I think it's a pretty good matchups here for rounds one and two. We'll find out what happens when July 25th comes around for the full FIFA World Cup draw after all the preliminary earlier rounds are finished.
Can I just say as well, just to quickly add, Barbados, mm-hmm. I think they've been given quite a good draw because they should beat comfortably US Virgin Islands. And then if they do, they've got Aruba in round two. And I think that Barbados have got more quality than Aruba. And I think that they are two very, very favourable draws for Barbados, who are another team that are making strides. And have got a technical director, Mark Falopo, who's a Brazilian, who's been... doing some good work over there on the island.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool to hear. All right, let's go to the under 20 tournament right now. You have to say, right now, with this tournament, I thought Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago were going to do a little bit better in Group A, even though they're in the U.S.'s group still. The way that I thought that both sides came out like gangbusters, I thought that they were going to actually do something, and then they just fell apart.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if we had too high expectations for Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago. I mean, Jamaica were always going to have a little bit more pressure on them because they are the hosts.
Mm-hmm.
And they both, to be honest, both countries have got some really, really talented players. I think Group A has been a lot tighter than Group B. I mean, Panama have absolutely dominated Group A. They've been a really good, solid team. And they haven't dropped a point yet. They've won every single game. And then hosts Jamaica after losing to USA yesterday.
Yes.
They're now officially eliminated along with Aruba. And Trinidad and Tobago stand a tiny, tiny chance of qualifying for the playoffs because they've got USA on Wednesday night, Trinidad and Tobago have. And I think they've got to beat them something by, 8 goals or something ridiculous. It was going to have to take a miracle. So more or less, Jamaica and Aruba are definitely eliminated, and more or less Trinidad and Tobago. And it's been a shame. I mean, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago played in the opener, and it looked as if TNT were going to absolutely, cruise to victory, going 2 goals up. But credit to Jamaica for fighting back. But both from then, from there on in, didn't really push on as much as they would have liked to have done. With Jamaica, fans have blamed 2 things. Firstly, they pointed the finger at the coach, Theodore Whitmore, who was in charge of the the national men's team for the 2014 qualifying for Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
He got them to the hex, but they didn't score enough goals, and they finished. They didn't manage to get through to Brazil. Apparently, his tactics have come under question. And secondly, They believe that there should be an overhaul of the youth development policy there in Jamaica. Winfried Scaffa, who's the Jamaican senior boss, he's come out and said that he doesn't think the current crop of under-20s with Jamaica are good enough to play for the national team. Because I think Scaffa's been there in attendance at a few games, or he's watched them somehow. And I probably agree. I mean, you've got players like Michael Seaton and Cardell Bembo who have been making a breakthrough into the seniors of late, but a lot of the other players, just aren't quite there. They're talented, but they haven't quite reached the stage where they'd be considered for the seniors. So, disappointing. And it looks as if now the best hope for a Caribbean team to get into the World Cup in New Zealand later this year is going to be with Haiti. Because, them in Group A, the 3 are all more or less eliminated. And then in Group B, you've got Cuba and Haiti. Haiti are probably the ones that we're all banking on to do the Caribbean proud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought Cuba was going to pull a major upset against Mexico. Ha! Foolish I am! Foolish I am!
9 goals later.
Exactly. I mean, it was a great goal to get off and running, to go 1-0 up, and then all of a sudden it's 9-1 down.
The issue with Cuba is they just cannot defend. They cannot defend. I mean, I remember, you're right, when Eddie Sanam, the guy that scored that wonder goal, I thought, right, they're in with a chance now. We all make mistakes. Mexico has started well. Maybe they'll be able to get back into it, but they had absolutely no defensive discipline or shape. And I think that's a key thing because, the gulf between maybe the Central American and the Caribbean sides isn't necessarily the talent. The skill and the talent is there. It's perhaps the structure and it's, you know, knowing how to win. I mean, you know, a classic example is Guatemala against Trinidad and Tobago in Group A. Don't know if you caught any of that game, but Guatemala won 2-0, and it was an absolute travesty because Trinidad and Tobago absolutely all over and peppered the opponent's goal, you know, dominated. But Guatemala had two chances, Rufus scored, and they knew how to win the game. And, you know, I said on Twitter, I'm just not sure if the Caribbean sides have that game-winning mentality and have that organization to be able to, you know, to get to these major tournaments over the Central American teams, you know?
I think that's the one thing about Cuba that I feel sorry for them, because they have great players. It doesn't matter if it's from baseball, football. They have wonderful players. They're strong. They're talented. It's just the structure as well as possibly the organization of not having your own league is probably right now harming not just the youth players but for senior players as well.
Yeah, well, they do have their own league in Cuba. But obviously, you know, with the communist political regime there, they're not allowed to legally leave the country or that league to go and play abroad. So usually they've got to defect. But they've got some good players. I mean, Cuba actually qualified for the 2013 edition of this Under-20 World Cup in 2013. So, you know, their players had the talent. They also had the mentality. And you know they were solid, and I'm not sure this current Cuban team are as good as the one that qualified 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely, and hopefully we'll see what the future lies with Cuba with these under-20 tournaments. Obviously, there'll be another one in another year or two after this coming up World Cup in New Zealand. You're going to I'm assuming the time difference isn't as brutal as it is over here.
Is that for the
under-20 World Cup?
Under 20. Yeah, I'm not sure about that at the moment. I would imagine obviously it depends on kickoff times. I would think that, say, if there's a 7 o'clock kickoff, it probably would be a bit late for people in the UK. But it very much depends on whether. I mean, my interest in it is obviously going to dwindle if no Caribbean team is able to make it. But how about in America? I mean, is that going to be a major time difference thing in New Zealand?
Oh, absolutely. It would probably be like 3 o'clock in the morning here because the Asian Cup is going on right now. You got the opening match is at 4 a.m. Eastern time.
Ooh.
Yes, exactly.
That's only for the dedicated then.
Yep, and my DVR. But other than that, Nathan, I have to say, you just got to say that you feel bad. We'll see what happens with Haiti, if they're the ones that are going to be the only Caribbean representative, hopefully, to get into the playoff. But
Haiti play tonight, actually.
Oh.
Haiti. So in Group B, there's a set of fixtures in Group B tonight. Cuba play Canada in around an hour and a half as well. So we'll see how they do. But, Haiti have actually only lost one game out of three so far. They've drawn their other two. And they've got a strong squad and a decent manager under Jerome Valfert as well. Very athletic, very physical, very strong, powerful side. I'm going to be honest with you, though, Daniel. I mean, at the start of the tournament, if you would have asked me to pick one Caribbean team that was going to make to qualify and for the playoffs and possibly make that advancement into the New Zealand finals, I probably would have said Jamaica or Trinidad and Tobago. And it's quite surprising that we're left in this situation where Haiti are, you know, flying the flag.
Absolutely. This is Nathan Carr, home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com. Nathan, thank you again so much, and I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
And that was Nathan Carr, the home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com. Of course, the Under-20 tournament is over. Congratulations to Tab Ramos and the U.S. Under-20s for qualifying for the Under-20 FIFA World Cup that will be in New Zealand. That'll be a heck of a time difference. I want to thank my guests, Manny Andrade and Tim Melikan from the Greater Lowell United FC Club of the NPSL. Thanks again to Michael Lewis of Big Apple Soccer. Thank you to head coach Steve Trichu, of the head coach of the Colorado Springs Switchbacks FC, and my good friend Kevin Laramie up in Montreal on the trade. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you so much for listening to me tonight. Don't forget about tomorrow, USA at Chile post-game show. Enjoy your football. Have a good night. Bye-bye for now. Take care, everybody.